Hi, and welcome to the ZP Vlog and Podcast. So we like to do this vlog and podcast once a week, and it's really just a sort of wrap-up from news that ZP has put out for the week. So during the week, we do you know, various webinars and blogs. One of the webinars we did this week, we did discuss electrochemical impedance spectroscopy. So I'd say that EIS, electrochemical impedance spectroscopy, is not super well utilised in the medical diagnostics field. I think the measurement of conductivity is used quite a lot in glucose strips. So you could argue that, you know, millions of chemical measurements are made a day, and actually they're electrochemical and it's in the glucose strip market. And actually there they use conductivity measurement, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to measure the what they call hematocrit, the total number of red blood cells in that sample, because they want to adjust the glucose signal accordingly. So when I make the statement impedance spectroscopy is not used that much, as a fraction or a subset of impedance spectroscopy, conductivity is used a lot. But this whole idea of impedance spectroscopy, where you have lots of frequencies and you really get a lot of analytical information out of that assay, no, that is not used an awful lot. Why? Well, historically, I think because the chips were not capable of it. And the mathematics or the computation required wasn't there. But now, actually, there are lots of chips and there is lots of computation. Which brings me on to something, actually, because something that wasn't in the webinars, but there are so many companies now, electronic companies, semiconductor companies, I should say, who are really interested in making electrochemical assay technologies or electrochemical assay sensors. I think you're going to find about five companies occupying or competing in this space pretty soon. So exciting times for us. Anyway, that said, we did cover the use of impedance spectroscopy this week in one of our webinars and its use in electrochemical assays. Now, something else that we did cover during the week was also that, you know, we have these developer zones. So we had one on the 4th of April, and there we talked about gold electrodes. At ZP, I think we make a really good gold electrode. Somebody was having some problems with it. I actually think it just came down to the connector in the end. And the really sweet thing is that every time we make a screen-rigid electrode, we test the electrodes. So in fact, when I was like looking at this particular person's, let's say, problem, I was actually able to find something like 40 to 48 data points of electrodes from that actual shipment that we sent to them. So everything they were testing was bad. Everything was bad. But everything we tested was great. And so you do have to ask yourself, you know, do we just ship all bad electrodes? But in fact, actually, I think they've just got a bad connector. And I did suggest then, you know, and I've seen this in the past where, unfortunately, you sort of, an electrochemical assay, an electrochemical experiment is only as good as its weakest link. And in this case, I think the weakest link was actually the connector. So I did advise them on that. And I also showed them some data as to what happens when you do have a poor connector, and actually it looks remarkably like what they actually had. We did have some inquiries this week about lactate sensors. Everyone's interested in lactate. It's a particularly interesting assay. You always find with lactate sensors, one of the biggest costs in doing a lactate sensor is actually the enzyme. It's so expensive, and it's not anywhere near as robust as the glucose equivalent, let's say. But we did discuss lactate sensors this week. Something I'm really sort of interested in as well, that really came up in one of our webinars, is the detection of heavy metal. Electrochemistry, I don't know how you put this in English, but it's the world's best assay technique for doing heavy metal detection. It's almost in the name, you know. Well, what I mean by this is a lot of heavy metals, what they're really concerned about is the ions, and electrochemistry is really good at doing ion detection. You can have ion selective electrodes, or actually you can have a process called anodic stripping voltammetry. And so we did discuss lead, cadmium and zinc in one of our webinars this week. And again, you know, everyone's very interested in continuous glucose monitoring. I think just this week, a company called BioLink down in San Diego just raised, I think, about another $49 million in order to work in the CGM space. They've already raised previously $100 million. So now they've raised another $49 million. Which I suspect could keep them going for about another year, so they will have to raise more. We did have a webinar today as well. Why? Because lots of questions are coming in. I don't like to leave big gaps between people asking a question and us giving a response. So we did talk about microneedles today. We did talk about phosphate sensors. We did talk about ATP, adenosine triphosphate. We did talk about connectors for screen printed electrodes. And we did talk about flow adapters for 10 millimeter working electrodes. And it was a, you know, it's a pretty intense webinar. And we covered lots of, let's say, stuff during that webinar. An interesting one this week as well is I kind of like, the thing about what we do at ZP is we, you know, we are synonymous with electroanalytical techniques, and then we start going deep into a particular application. So an application that we're going quite deep into these days is food ingredients testing. And so one of those would happen to be ginger. And when you look into ginger, you start finding out that the pungency of ginger is probably due to at least two molecules, six gingerol and 10 gingerol. And then there's a minor player among them called Shogal. And Shogal, though, is about 1%. But somebody was asking us about the relative pungencies of these different molecules in ginger that give it its pungency. And I said, if you were looking at chili, in chili there's a good capsaicin and dihydrocapsaicin. There's these molecules are then assigned relative Scoville heat units. So you can kind of say, well, you know, this molecule gives you this much heat, this molecule gives you this much heat. But that kind of information is just not there in ginger. But we were asked a question and it stimulated some thinking. What was really nice as well is actually we did get some really nice feedback from the person who asked the question as well. They sort of were surprised that we would have answered it in so much detail. And I think that's what takes people by surprise before they actually realize, you know, who ZP are. You know, that in fact, you know, we do take the science super serious. And, you know, people ask us a question, we will try and give a sincere answer. Which brings us on to another question that it's kind of interesting to see because sometimes people will, you know, at ZP, we make products, we send products, we support the products. And somebody will say, oh, well, I was using your chili sensor and it gave me two different numbers. And I'm, you know, when you're thinking about things like if I measure Tabasco sauce, I might get a result that's 5,000 and then I might get another result that's 5,500. You might say, that's terrible. That's different by 500. But the relative difference between those two is like, you know, 10%. I mean, when you're using natural products, that's completely fine. So I think people, you're not going to get the exact same number every time, in fact, when you're looking after, when you're measuring natural products. And so we did get a question and said, oh, we're getting different results. But I also then demonstrated to them that, look, you know, if we measure a particular source, we might get 94,000 Scoville heat units. We might get 101 Scoville heat units. We might get 93,000 Scoville heat units. Actually, those are very similar numbers. It's just the numbers very large. So you can kind of, you think somebody says, oh, well, the difference was 7,000. And then somebody goes, wow, that's a lot. But when you realize it's 7,000 because one of them was 93,000, the other one was 100,000, the 7,000 is really within experimental error. So, that said, food sense, you know, which is something that does feature quite a lot these days in the work that we do at ZP. We're actually on generation 4 of it, and so we did put a bit of an image up this week because when we first shipped it, it was this like brushed metallic box, and then it became a black box, so it looked a bit more like a product. Then it became a small black box, and now it's become something that's really quite elegant. I almost say, I almost describe it as like Apple-like in its look and feel. So we're very proud of the way FoodSense Generation 4 has actually got to, let's say, the next stage in its evolution. And I think this is something that people don't really think about when starting a company, that actually making products and making a company is a real journey. You know, so we're now 10 years into ZP, and one of our lead products is this FoodSense/SensiAll platform, and it looks good and it works well. But we've been doing it 10 years, and I think sometimes that maybe there's, when people go for kind of VC funding, there's a rush to make something great really quickly. But I think it's actually really hard because you have to kind of get it all right first time. And, you know, there we are, we're on generation 4 of our product. When I think about companies like Sony, great companies now, but they didn't actually start off VC funded. They actually started off as quite small companies. Unfortunately, you know, it took them decades to get where they're at. So that's maybe the thing that kind of frustrates people. But maybe sometimes if something's good, you actually have to take your time over it. But, you know, I do support people who do their VC funding and start their companies. it's not an easy journey. And I mean, I talk about it quite a bit. You know, the probability of success is something like, you know, 1 in 10. So it's not easy. Something that we are very proud of at the moment. And in fact, we just shipped some more gold electrodes to a particular client. So the nice thing about with working with ZP is when, like, you know, somebody contacted me, they said I needed a gold screen printed electrode for doing immunoassays. I said, look, you know, this is the electrode that we use. This will work. And then I'm also sending them information then to sort of, because I know what problems they will have. And so I'm able to send them information ahead of time to kind of, you know, prevent them from having problems. It sounds like a week of problems this week, but somebody is using a lactate sensor of ours. And I knew that they had a potassium sensor that was looking good. The beautiful thing about ZP is actually we tested these lactate sensors before we shipped to them. And so when they're having completely flat signal, I was able to say, I genuinely think there's a problem with the instrument itself. Now they've come back to me and I've said to them, tell me about, you know, give me some more details. But, you know, the fact that we're willing to, you know, talk about the troubleshooting that we give these clients and the problems that they're having. The reason we do this is then is to kind of educate and prevent other people from having the same problems as well. It's funny that people think that problems sometimes come down to, you know, come down to sensors or screen printed electrodes. It's actually, when I think about it, the problem with lactate that somebody's having and the problem somebody's having screen printed electrodes comes down to connectors. I think it's really overlooked how important these are. I remember one time I was in a lab and somebody had screen printed electrodes and they were actually soldering wires on the screen printed electrodes so that they could then connect with these things. And it was just, it's such a bad philosophy that in fact they were doing this soldering onto screen printed electrodes, a very slow process. You know, you want to, if you're doing development, if it's research or you're doing product development, you want to put the sensor in there. You want to do your functionalization. You want to test. You want to see how good the data was. You want to get onto the next experiment. Not rushing, but you have to have a throughput of tests. So when I saw somebody soldering once onto a screen printed electrode, I thought, no, this is wrong. You're failing, but you're going to fail really slowly and failing slowly means failing very expensively. So be careful of sort of anything manual that's time consuming, like having to solder onto screen printed electrodes. It's every time you want to do a test, it's a little bit crazy. As I say, we did do some work this week on detecting lead, and lead is something that we can definitely do on the SensiOR platform. Something that does come around, you know, every week is CGM, continuous glucose monitoring. So I think at this point I've managed to sort of reduce it down to, if you have very little budget, ZP has a single purpose biosensor circuit that's good. We have these CGM sensors and we have the test solutions. So people really can do a sort of proof of principle, pretty low cost, using the ZP technology stack. As I say, connectors are pretty important. So I did do a whole sort of webinar on connectors this week as well. So next week we will have the FoodSense webinars. We will have our normal webinars on the ZP technology stack. At the end of April, we've got a webinar dedicated to SensiOR, and we're also going to have a webinar dedicated to actually our academic colleagues and sort of, you know, trying to highlight the technologies at ZP that we think can really help academia. And I always think about this, you know, academia to market. Well, sometimes I understand people don't want to get to market, but in the end, you know, this is a philosophy of mine for science, especially practical sciences like electrochemical assay development. For them to have a real impact in the real world, they probably do have to be productized. So even if the final ambition is not to be an entrepreneur and a business owner, that's fine. But it's good to kind of at least have that could be the end goal for the technology. Otherwise, it will just remain in the lab and it won't impact society. So I think if you've got any questions at ZP, don't hesitate to reach out to us. We have been invited to give a few talks, which I've been happy to accept. So happy to have feedback from people, happy to have received questions. And if you've got any technical questions, sure to post them on contact us at ZP, and I'm sure that they'll get answered in the webinars. Okay, thanks very much.